You're listening to Just Ask the Question, Adventures in Reporting with your host, Brian Karam.
Hi, and welcome back to Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, with our weekly review of the news called Just Ask the Press. And with me, as always, is former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and current editor-at-large from CQ Roll Call, John T. Bennett. And guys, we're here today to talk about a lot of stuff. The latest New York Times poll is out, and woe be unto Joe Biden, according to the latest in the polls. The Supreme Court has delayed its immunity case on Donald Trump. Will Fannie be removed down in Georgia? That's the devil went down there, and we'll see what soul he stole. Meanwhile, the Manhattan case is scheduled now to be the first to go to trial against Donald Trump. Biden and Donald Trump were on the border this week. That was quite a display. And then finally, Mitch McConnell steps down from leadership in the Senate. Longest leader in the Senate for the Republicans is stepping down. So stick around. We've got that and a lot more when we come back.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth with Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not released anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam. With me, as always, to discuss on Just Ask the Press, our weekly review of the news, is former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and editor-at-large from CQ Roll Call, John Bennett. We're going to start out with, John, the latest New York Times poll. And, man, it does. If you read the headlines, it don't look good for Biden. And he's behind. Donald Trump's ahead. Here's one that says, in another worrying sign for President Joe Biden's reelection prospects, new polling published on Saturday shows him losing a double digit percentage of his 2020 supporters to former President Donald Trump. What's it all about, Alfie? Is it time to panic in the Biden camp?
If it's not officially time for them to panic, they're getting awful darn close, aren't they? The one thing about this poll, and I just looked to verify, you know, I've been saying here and elsewhere and writing it this way for really months that, you know, you look at one poll and Biden's up 3. You look at another poll, Trump's up 2, a third poll and they're tied. So, you know, all of this was in the margins of errors of these polls. One thing that jumped out at me when I saw this, this is a 5-point lead. Now, it's a national lead for Trump, and we know how the Electoral College works. But still, this is the first time that I've seen in one of these more widely respected polls that either one of them had a lead that was larger than the margin of error. And for me, that's always an indicator that one side should be getting worried. And I think the Biden camp, I think this got their attention from, you know, everything we were able to glean today. Excuse me. Now, remember, I did see someone point out today that this poll also predicted the red wave that didn't happen in the last midterm elections. And that would have been House Republicans sweeping to, you know, a 30-seat majority. And they ended up with a 5-seat majority. So polls can get it wrong. Of course, we think we learned that in 2016. But from leadership to likability to favorability, whatever that is, to, you know, questions about Biden's policies and his age, especially his age, even though he's only, as Biden pointed out last week on the Seth Meyers show, Trump's only 4 years younger than him. And I watched part of a Trump rally this weekend, and I lost count of how many mistakes and just, you know, it seems like confusing things. You know, Trump confuses people. There was some of that yesterday as well from Trump. So You got to be worried if you're the Biden people. And oh, by the way, the other guy, as Biden has called Trump forever, he's facing 91 criminal charges or 91 counts. And
Felony
he's
counts in
still
four
losing.
different
And
jurisdictions.
he's still losing to the guy. And, this time Siena poll comes after swing state polls. Trump's up in most of the swing states. Now, Biden still has a path to to being reelected. But there's just no momentum. He never seems to have any momentum. Even.
What do you mean by, is it momentum among the press? Because we've been pillorying him. And are we missing it? Is the press missing it?
I think the press does miss, especially like the Trump flubs. I mean, Biden flubs things all the time. Biden mixed up Ukraine and Gaza during an Oval Office pool spray on Friday. And Trump appeared to forget the name of his wife, Melania. So I
No, not
think the
appeared.
thing
He
with
actually did. That's
the
it.
thing with Trump, I think on the Trump coverage, we do miss the age. We don't really cover it because there's so much ground to cover with Trump. All the legal stuff, the can't, you know, his campaign really all that flush with cash and all the outrageous things that he says. We don't get there. And I do think that is a shortcoming so far of the coverage of this campaign because, like I said, Trump makes mistakes every time he gets behind a microphone.
Yeah, he does. Michael, you had a thought on this,
Sure.
I know.
Yeah, I do. We've learned from past elections that branding matters a lot. And if you're branded as the next generation of leadership, John Kennedy, that carries you a long way. If you're the swift boat fraudster in John Kerry's case, that carries you a long way in the wrong direction. If Al Gore is a serial liar or exaggerator, that hurts too. And so the effort by the Republicans, of course, is to brand Biden as too old and perhaps in cognitive decline. And fair enough if he is old and he does make mistakes, but Trump is old and makes as many, if not more, mistakes. And so what I just don't get is why the press is not being even-handed in constantly pointing out, in Biden's case, that he makes mistakes and just focusing on Trump's legal questions. Because people are, their point of view on legal questions is, I think, sort of essentially baked in. But he hasn't been branded on the matter of age and cognitive condition. And I think it behooves the media to treat both of these candidates equally on those very important issues. So what do I say about the New York Times Siena poll? Well, Trump's unfavorability rating remains constant at 54. In 2020, it was at 54. In 2024, it's at 54. His favorability rating in 2020, 43. Today, 44. So he is where he is, and he's not going anywhere. So that's that. I mean, he's sort of maxed out, and it doesn't seem like he has any room to increase. And so if that's the case, then Biden has, an opportunity. In 2020, he had a 52% favorability rating. Today, he has a 38% favorability rating. It's sort of incumbent on him to change the narrative and, make the case to the American people on two fronts. One is authoritarianism versus democracy. That's his lead. And then two, as we've talked about over and over, people don't seem to appreciate, not that they discount it, but don't even seem to appreciate the numbers of policy positions that have become law that have been beneficial to the average American, for whether it be debt forgiveness or environmental sanity or
During the
tax
Biden
issues
administration.
during the
Yeah.
administration, infrastructure. I mean, people, when the question that always makes me and say this when people say, has Biden done anything for you, you know, sort of personally? And they say, no, that's an uninformed voter in my mind, because there is a lot of stuff that for the average middle class voter, Biden's policies have been helpful. The big problem is, of course, that we've talked about, and at least in my point of view, is corporate greed. And I think that part of the reason that prices are as high as they are is not because the economic conditions demand it, but rather because corporations are taking advantage, you know, from their point of view of what they can get away with. And prices are, I think, artificially inflated. And I think that has to be called out by Biden, and he just isn't doing it. So it's his to lose, I think, because I think Trump is where he is, and he will always be where he is. He can't go up. He can only go down. And
well,
let's see what happens.
That's a good question, John. Do you think that Trump has maxed himself out, as he said, and do you think it's Biden's to lose? And do you think that Biden is, during his time in office, has passed stuff that should be noted by the general public as being helpful to the average American citizen?
I still think this is something of a dead heat. I don't think it's Biden's to lose. I think it's winnable for either guy, and it's losable by either guy.
Do you think Trump has maxed out his support?
Well, I don't think it matters if Trump maxes out his support today or the morning of the election. What matters is how many of those people actually go vote. And we know from the Times poll and other polls that part of Biden's challenge is he has to win back big or sizable parts of his 2020 coalition. They're voting blocks, Hispanics, blacks, and now Arab Americans and some progressives who aren't happy with various parts of his presidency. So Biden has the additional task of trying to bring people back into his tent, which he's going to spend a lot of time doing that. If Trump's already got a full tent and they vote, you know, And they all go vote, especially in the 6 or 8 states, ball game. You know, Trump's going back to the White House.
Well, here's the question then. But the question, and you touch it, you nudge up on it. Who votes? Are they happy and are they unhappy enough with Biden that they vote for Donald Trump when they know it would hurt them to vote for Donald Trump? Or are they unhappy enough not to vote at all, which is also, by the way, a vote for Donald Trump? To me, that's where it ends up, is at the end of the day. And I will. And Michael, you said something that's pretty self-evident to anybody who's covered politics for a while. And that is
most of the points, Brian, I make are self-evident. I don't have really much insight.
Hey now. But the point is real that if the president of the United States, why is it with Trump as nefarious, as disgusting, as demented, as criminally insane as he is? If that guy is running neck and neck with you, you can't blame the press for that. Where is the messaging on the Democratic side? This is all about, as I've said for months, about and for 48 months, damn near, that the Biden administration does not understand nor appreciate effective communications. Michael,
What's interesting? But you know what's interesting, though, with all of this, Democrats keep winning every special election.
Yeah.
And so on policy matters, whether it be choice or infrastructure or whatever, they keep winning. So in the end, does policy make a difference? You've got this in vitro issue out of Alabama. That's got to be, you know, something that's scary to women nationally.
Well, I think that's scary for a number of reasons. For example, you could be raped and be forced to bear the child that would be from the rapist. Yet if you're a consenting couple who want to have children, you're not going to be able to because there's no in vitro fertilization. It's frightening to me, but go ahead. What do I know?
The one thing that John DeLaVolpe is a pollster at Harvard. When I was doing my fellowship up there, his office is right across from mine. And I talked to him. He's an expert in youth voting and voting generally. And he points out that Biden is dramatically overperforming Trump among senior citizens, one of the most reliable voting blocks there is. And so, you know, it's again, turnout matters. And then I guess the other thing is, what do the Nikki Haley voters do? Nikki Haley has, you know, a solid 20-ish percent of Republican vote. Leave aside the independents and Democrats who cross over in South Carolina or New Hampshire, but she's still getting 20% of the vote. Where do those people go?
Yeah, that's a good question. Do they not vote? Do they not vote, or do they go for, some of them will definitely go to Biden. I'm sure some of them would go to an independent candidate. And at the end of the day, what you point out, what you both point out, is where do these people look, folks? As the number of registered voters go, the Republican Party is a minority party. The Democrats, if everyone showed up to vote, this wouldn't even be close. The question is, at the end of the day, who shows up to vote? In this country, we believe that 50% voter turnout is a good voter turnout. And that's just not true. You got to get to 75% before the will of the people begins to emerge at any real, you know, noticeable voting output. So that's not my thought. We'll move on from here.
Can I just say one thing?
Yeah.
I would rephrase what you just said. You said it's about who shows up to vote. I also think it's a matter of who's allowed to show up to vote, because Amen. Your comment that Republicans are a minority, and that's why they're working feverishly to suppress Democrat voter opportunities, whether it be early voting, absentee voting, felony voting. All of these things are efforts to prevent people from voting. So it's not simply who shows up to vote, but who is
allowed,
disallowed.
Yeah.
From whose votes are not counted, what states are purging people from voter rolls. I mean, all that stuff
matters.
It matters. Yeah.
Agreed. And moving on from there on things that matter, the Supreme Court decided to take up a case this week. Donald Trump's maintainment that he has unlimited immunity. And so it has further delayed the case that it would be heard in D.C. And I'd like you to unpack that and all the other goings on in the court this week, Michael, if you will.
Sure. The case that you're referencing now is the immunity for criminal actions by former presidents. Trump has maintained in the January 6th case, in part of the Mar-a-Lago case, that as a former president, he has absolute immunity from criminal activity undertaken during his presidency. So if you look at Mar-a-Lago, for example, some of that activity, taking documents from the White House to Mar-a-Lago, are acts taken while he was president. The obstructing of the investigation is 100% action when he's not president. So even if he had immunity, it would not impact the obstruction of justice case directly, indirectly for sure, because he'd say, look, I took these documents, I'm allowed to have them, I don't have to cooperate with them, and I wasn't obstructing, I was just maintaining that which I was allowed to hold. So I mean, you can argue that. But on January 6th case, he's saying flat out, these acts that I took were in the outer limits of my authority as president. And just as I have immunity in the civil cases, I can't be sued for actions taken by me in the official conduct of my office, even if it's the outer limits of it, I should have the same sort of protection for criminal activity. And that's what the Supreme Court has decided to take. And during the week of April 22nd, they will have oral argument on that question of, does he have absolute immunity? Or if he doesn't have absolute immunity, does he have any, are there any circumstances where he could have some form of immunity? And the case is fraught with all sorts of dangers for those who want Trump to go to trial before the election, or really before the inauguration, because he can go to trial. He can be on trial between November and January 6th. But so they're going to hear that case. And the question will be, what's their answer? But also, how long does it take before we get that answer? Remember, in the Nixon tapes Watergate case, it took the court, I think, just over 2 weeks to issue a decision. And Bush versus Gore, seems like every week as the case went up to the Supreme Court back, they were giving decisions. So if they follow the timetable of either of those cases and Trump's argument loses, so the week of April 22nd, let's say they argue it on the 23rd, and we follow 16 days from that, that's the end of April. We can get a decision. Early May, we get a decision. The judge in that case has said the parties probably need about 6 weeks to get ready. So early May, you get a decision, or mid-May, you get a decision. Mid-June, end of June, you could have a trial come early July, mid-July, with no problem, if the Supreme Court, you know, moves this case along. In theory, they should be moving it faster than their normal end date of June, because they've taken it on an expedited basis. So expedited, but pivoting now just for a second on the timeline, we'll get to the substance of it. The Colorado case, the whether Trump can appear on the ballot in Colorado, that was argued about a month ago. And everybody is predicting that there's going to get a decision on that tomorrow. Supreme Court has noted on its website that there will be a decision announced tomorrow. So everybody's, you know, on high alert that it'll be Colorado, because the Colorado primary is Tuesday. But so that was a month-long decision. So if they take a month to do this, and we get May 23rd for a decision date, or June 1st for a decision date, and it's 6 weeks, then, you know, you're pushing it closer and closer.
And then, then the idea, of course, that the on the run up to election, it's too close to the election to put him on trial, so delay it until
that's not DOJ policy. DOJ policy doesn't prevent judges from trying cases that have been indicted. It's supposed to be like taking investigative steps about unindicted cases.
And do you view the SCOTUS decision, because it was Jack Smith who asked for them to expedite it and cast judgment on it prior to this, and they wanted the lower court to take a whack at it first. Do you see this as play as SCOTUS being favoring Donald Trump?
Well, I don't think that they are acting overtly politically. I was hoping that when the Supreme Court decided not to take it, you know, initially, and let it go to the Court of Appeals, that if you had a unanimous, strong Court of Appeals decision,
which they had,
we don't need to take this, but they didn't. So they built in, by the way they decided to let the case proceed, a month, at least 5 weeks of additional delay. You know, and people who want to view it as political, they can view it as political. I don't think
political.
The Supreme Court. On Trump-related criminal and criminally related matters, this Supreme Court has not been overly favorable to Trump. They haven't in any of all the election interference cases. They haven't been favorable to him. They're favorable to him on policies that he agrees with them on, choice and environment and government regulation and all that stuff. But that was their politics to begin with. That's why they were appointed. So it's not like they're doing Donald Trump any favor. They're just following their personal beliefs. Anyway.
So that now, and the point about the decision, there's this thing from Greg Germain, a law professor at Syracuse, who told Newsweek that the Supreme Court will likely insist that Jack Smith, who is leading the prosecution, will have to prove a very narrow this will be decided on a very narrow question, which is, did Donald Trump, were his intentions beyond a reasonable doubt? And here's the quote. I think the court will require the government to prove by a high standard that Trump knowingly attempted to interfere with a fair vote count and direct that the immunity issue be considered before proceeding to the merits. Does that make sense to you, that it will be on that narrow basis that they will decide?
I'm not sure that I follow it exactly. The Supreme Court has got to decide whether or not a former president enjoys immunity, and if so, under what circumstances. And so the question is, are there any circumstances which you could be immune from criminal prosecution for acts undertaken in office? That's the question. And they could decide that, yeah, there are circumstances where a former president could have immunity for actions taken in the outer boundaries of his presidency, but that doesn't apply in this case. In this case, the conduct alleged can by no means be viewed as part of one's official duties, just like they ruled in the Mark Meadows case. Remember, Meadows argued his case should be removed from state court to federal court. Why? Because what he was doing in his election interference behavior was, he said, part of his official duties. And the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals said, absolutely not. Interfering with an election is not part of your official duties. Full stop, you're in trial in Georgia. So this court could say, look, we don't decide ultimately whether under any hypotheticals there can be no immunity for criminal prosecution for official acts, but that's not this case. And as we look at the facts of this case, or what I fear most, Brian, actually, is that they say there may be circumstances where, and when we don't deal with hypotheticals here, the Supreme Court talking now, there may be circumstances where a former president could enjoy immunity from criminal prosecution. And so we're going to send this case back. We're going to remand this case to the court for further hearings and determinations about whether or not the conduct alleged in this case can be said to be part of his official duties. And so that could go back to Chutkan. Chutkan can say it doesn't. Then it goes to the Court of Appeals again, and then it goes up to the Supreme Court. If they remand for further fact-finding, the likelihood of getting this case to trial is even more significantly impaired.
Wow.
So I think that they it behooves them to say, on the facts before us, this president does not enjoy presidential immunity, and send it back so that a trial can begin at the end of the summer.
That's pretty frightening. Frightening.
Yeah, and then what everyone is holding their breath about is the possibility that tomorrow the Supreme Court decides the Colorado case, which is the question of whether or not Trump can or can't be on the ballot. From the oral arguments, as we discussed previously, the court doesn't seem inclined to say that he could be kicked off the ballot, and that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment needs some sort of congressional action for it to be effective, non-self-executing, as they say. And that's what people are expecting in that case. And, you know, it's not outcome determinative of anything. Yes, it's important in terms of an analysis of the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, but Trump's on that ballot anyway. If he's not on the ballot, they'll write him in. So, you know, it's...
Well, John, let me ask you, you've heard this as it's unfolded. Donald Trump is playing all this as if he's won in the court, and that it's all benefiting him, and that the deep state is failing because good patriots are coming forward.
I had not heard the good patriots part. I I did late last week, for the first time I was able to imagine Trump getting away with everything, and some of these cases going away, other cases being delayed long enough for him to be sworn in and then give an order to dismiss any remaining federal charges. Whatever's coming in the hush money case, he's not going to jail for that. What's another fine at this point? He owes $500 million already. So I saw
And he has no
a
money.
scenario.
He's asking, hey, here, I'll give you a
Not
hundred
gonna.
million, we'll call it even.
He might not be able to pay the fines anyway, so what's another
Yeah.
one? Other cases go away, maybe the Georgia case. The two attorney prosecutors are dismissed. There's a panel that would have to find other prosecutors. Maybe nobody wants to get involved, and that case goes away. Trump is reelected, sworn in, drops the charge, the remaining federal charges, and it's like none of this ever happened. I saw how those stars could align for the first time. I've said here before that, who outruns 91 charges, right?
He ain't Neo in the Matrix. He can't
We'll
dodge
see.
91
We'll
bullets.
see. I think for I'm not ruling it out for the first time.
There you go. Well, with that thought, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, Michael, I'll let you unpack some of the rest of it, including Georgia and the Manhattan case and the Mar-a-Lago case. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, Just Ask the Question podcast listeners. If you've got a second, head on over to Twitter and follow our official page, JATQ Podcast. That's JATQ Podcast.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth with Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not found anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we are back. It's Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, and it is our weekly review of the news, Just Ask the Press. And with us, as always, is former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and editor at large from CQ Roll Call, John T. Bennett. And when we left, we were talking about the wonderful idea of that Donald Trump could avoid prosecution on 91 felony charges, get away with being in debt for several hundred million dollars, and still being president next year. What a wonderful concept. So, Michael, I'll let you, one of the things they're trying to do is remove Fani Willis from the prosecution in Georgia. And then, as John said, if they do that, maybe it won't be prosecuted. And at the same time, the Mar-a-Lago case, there was some rebuke this week, some stepping up of the judge there, but there's still calls for her removal, saying that she's not fit to be a federal judge. And then, of course, they call the weakest case is going to be the first one to go to trial, and that's in the Manhattan case, which involves our friend Michael Cohen. So I'll let you unpack some of that.
Okay, so let's start with Georgia. In Georgia, they've been in hearings on and off for a week or two now of trial of courtroom days. The question is, did Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade, the independent prosecutor she hired, engage in conduct that merits their removal from the case? The case was put on this hearing because of the question of whether or not Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade engaged in sort of financial impropriety. It has morphed from that a little bit to has Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade lied to the court in their testimony about when the relationship that they admitted to between them started? Was Fannie Willis's behavior outside of the courtroom, where she gave a fiery speech at a church, the sort of behavior from a prosecutor in a ongoing litigation that violates bar ethics rules? And the judge is going to make a decision in the next 2 weeks. The only thing that matters to me in that case is that the district attorney's office not be disqualified. Whether he asks Fannie Willis to step aside or Nathan Wade to step aside is besides the point. As long as that office is not disqualified from proceeding, presuming that Fannie Willis's deputy agrees with her theory of the case, that case will proceed. If he removes the district attorney's office from the case, as John pointed out, then there's a body, a commission, that has to appoint a new district attorney's office to handle it. There are very few in Georgia of the size that can handle that type of case and still handle the regular, you know, day in and day out blocking and tackling sort of cases. And we know that the one defendant, the current lieutenant governor, who Fannie Willis held a political fundraiser for his opponent, she got disqualified from that case. And that was a year ago. And they still haven't appointed a prosecutor for that one defendant. So if her office gets disqualified, that really is a terrible blow for the prospect of that case proceeding. And I think that the judge understands that. And so I think that he'll probably be looking for a way to make sure that the office that he worked in is not disqualified wholly. And if you know, Willis and Wade have to go, fine. A lot of people that talk to me about lawyering in Georgia, in Atlanta, say that Wade's not the strongest attorney to try that case in any event. So maybe, no loss there. But anyway, so that's that. We'll hear, the judge said he'll have a hearing on that in 2 weeks' time. In Mar-a-Lago, Judge Cannon held a hearing the other day, and the questions presented were whether or not she's going to keep sealed the names of witnesses at the request of the government for fear that they will be targeted and face physical and mental harm by being identified. She's taken that under advisement. And then the second more perilous case for the prosecutor is the motion by Trump to let him interrogate current national security intelligence officials in the Biden administration on the theory that somehow there's this big conspiracy in the intelligence community to target him. That one should be a non-starter because there's no factual predicate for it. It's just a theory. But the judge said, well, let me think about that. You know, so if she goes forward with that, that's going to really slow the Mar-a-Lago case down. So we'll see what she says. And she's not going to be removed. I mean, she could be reversed. She could be reversed like she was on the first act she took in this case, but she's not going to be removed. Then finally, you raise the Manhattan District Attorney's case, which starts in 20-ish days. That's the question of whether or not Trump engaged in fraud in the way he treated payments to Stormy Daniels. The allegations that have been made is that he paid her hush money to keep her quiet from alleging that he and she had an affair in the days just before the election. And rather than pay her the money directly, which he was allowed to do, there's nothing illegal about paying hush money. He went through this circuitous route of giving the money to Michael Cohen to give to her. And then he gave back the Michael Cohen loan, if you will, by representing on his books that it was for legal fees and other consulting matters. And then on the books and records of Manhattan, that's how they represented what those payments to Cohen were. So, I mean, they're clear fraud, but there are some legal issues in it. It's a misdemeanor, and they're trying to get a misdemeanor ratcheted up to a felony, and it involves a federal election and not a state election. So there are legal barriers. On the facts, however, if it's just a question of did Trump engage in business fraud by the manner in which he represented that money on his books. It's a slam dunk case. It's a straightforward case. He, you know, he paid, as you know, Brian, better than me, he told Cohen, get her that money. And he took out a loan and he got her that money. And they, and so her story was killed by the National Enquirer or whoever else, before the election. They didn't want another one of those Access Hollywood sort of eruptions just before the election. And rather than just pay Cohen back, he decided to, he was going to represent it as legal fees, which it flat out wasn't. So, I mean, it's, the fraud is apparent. It's just there are some technical legal issues around whether or not the statutes that they're using can be used in the way they are. So when you say it's a weak case, not factually, but maybe there are some legal hurdles that they got to get over where the case could get theoretically dismissed because they failed to state a, you know, a proper felony, or that it wasn't, you know, a New York state election and the laws there govern New York state elections, not federal. So there are issues like that, but not on the facts. The facts, as you know, Brian, you know Michael Cohen better than any of us here. And that's
no, the facts are pretty sound. That's,
and David Pecker will testify, the head of the National Enquirer, I think, will testify to the same thing. Have either of you heard anything about what's going on with Weisselberg in this case? Because I thought there was some conversation about whether Weisselberg would now finally be a witness against Trump in this case, but I haven't heard anything since an initial story.
I haven't either.
A long time ago.
John, have you?
No, that does dawn a memory. I don't think that's a phrase either, but.
So the question I have for you, John, is all that we've just unpacked in court won't matter to the faithful that are that is Donald Trump. He continues to use this to campaign on. And is this another indictment of what we do in the press for not making people aware of the true problem or the scope of it?
Who's not who, other than conservative media? When are we not doing that? When are we not televising these trials and these hearings? You know, gun to tape. We're doing. They're carrying them live. Even Fox.
And isn't that? But that
the information is out there. If people want to take it in, or if they just want to, if they want to just filter it through their usual filter and have Jesse Waters tell them what to think at 8 o'clock, which I suspect is what's going on in over half the country.
Yeah, and he makes hay off of all of it. He uses, you know, there's the old adage, there's no such thing as bad publicity. He certainly is proving that to be true.
He lives.
You know what's
that.
Interesting? Can I just say one thing? What's interesting about the politics of this? I was just thinking about this in the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court is poised, they say, to issue a ruling on the Colorado case tomorrow, right? The day before Super Tuesday, the betting money is that they will not kick him off the ballot. Now, in some sense, they should be mindful of the political, you know, implications of that, because the day before the primary, if the Supreme Court rules that Trump was improperly kicked off of a ballot, that's a huge political talking point for him, right? It proves the point that he's trying to make over and over, that all these things are politically motivated. And here I am on the brink of this thing. And the Supreme Court recognized that this was political and, you know, come vote for me so I can continue to protect you. So, you know, in some sense, the Supreme Court should have waited until after the primary if they're going to make a decision tomorrow, because it gives him a talking point on the eve of an election that's very favorable to him.
Amen, John.
Yeah, I think that, to your point, Brian, that about how he uses everything to his own advantage. I mean, I've never covered or known anyone quite like this. I mean, we've all probably known people in our lives who have maybe a weaker form of this gene that Donald Trump has. I mean, he's leading in the swing states. He's Joe Biden should be up by 10 points everywhere.
Yeah.
If you just looked at it on paper, and, you know, even if you took their personalities out of it and you just laid it all down on paper in black and white and thought about it kind of very simply, Biden should be up 10 points.
So what do you think is the one thing that Biden could do to turn it around?
I honestly don't know if there's anything he can do.
Well, wow. Here you go. So if Trump's theory...
When Michael's finished, I'd like to hear, Brian, if you think he could do anything to turn around.
Okay, Michael.
So here's my smart aleck answer. According to Donald Trump, a president cannot be held liable for the criminal acts undertaken while in office unless he's convicted first in an impeachment trial. So he should just kill Trump. Just shoot him dead. He'll be immune.
By the way, if you're a member of the Secret Service, I did not say that.
That was Michael Zeldin.
That was Michael Zeldin, former federal prosecutor.
Right. No, but I'm saying that I say that just to say how preposterous the Trump argument is.
Of course it is.
If it were true.
Right.
If it were true.
Well, yeah, not only is it preposterous, but at the same time that he's claiming unlimited immunity, the Republicans in Congress are investigating Joe Biden. So if he has unlimited immunity, why are you investigating him?
That's my answer. Just shoot him dead. You know, just shoot him dead.
And again, if they bust in your door during this podcast, it's Michael Zeldin, folks.
I've moved on from bombing people to just, you know, domestic terrorism. So you should be happy that I'm bringing it all back home.
Well,
as Bob Dylan
used to say. In all honesty, John, that to me, here's the thing, and it pisses me off time and again. Because the simple fact of the matter is, you got to get out there and push back more. You've got to take all the oxygen out of the room. You can't give Donald Trump any room to maneuver. So it's having your minions and your staffers and your administration officials out on, you know, out at the sticks. It's having them on the North Lawn. It's having them on the shows. It's the President of the United States showing up in the briefing room. And in a press conference and taking hard questions from the press. So you're in front of the press all the time, not Donald Trump, because Donald Trump's minions just see Donald Trump going, well, there's a president. He great. He's out there again. The Lord has anointed him as the spokesman for us. But if you don't see him and you see Biden, then you have to rethink it. And they're not going to rethink it unless they see him more often. This is, in effect, I think it's without a doubt another, you know, nail in a coffin if he doesn't get his butt out there and talk more. And that to me is the only thing that you can do. That, and I'm not going to recommend that, you know, that anything that Michael said over there. I'm just going to say that what you could do is also have, you know, the cognitive testing. That's the other thing. Why isn't the Democratic Party putting out all these? Why aren't they putting out ads with all the flubs that Trump does? I mean, my God, I strung them together. There's somebody else on the internet who does. And here's the other thing. The Biden administration mistakes social media for real media. And they don't understand that a lot of people who vote are not those who are watching TikTok and YouTube.
Yeah.
And they don't reach out to the people who are voting, even though, as Michael pointed out earlier, many senior citizens who do vote already favor Joe Biden. So I don't know if the polls are accurate, but I know that the president of the United States is missing a great opportunity to push back against the moron Donald Trump. And that to me is the biggest failing again of the Biden administration. And with that said, I want to move on to the two of them and their wonderful trip to the border.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. We're talking to you, and we need your help. As you probably know, independent journalism is a vital pillar of our democracy. Like everything else, it's not free. We're asking all longtime listeners of the show to help support us by becoming a member on Patreon. For the price of a latte, you can help guard democracy. Join us today at patreon.com/JATQ podcast to help us keep bringing you the podcast you love and the facts you deserve.
Now, Biden went down to Brownsville, and of course Donald Trump went to wherever the Donald Trumps Eagle Pass, wherever the Donald Trumps of the world go. And in the past, and I'll start with back Mondale, and this is goes back to Joe to Walter Mondale when he ran against Ronald Reagan in 1984. They wanted to go down to the border to prove that they had something, you know, in their pocket. So the week before the election, Walter Mondale went down to the valley, Rio Grande Valley, Brownsville area, and said, soon the polls won't matter anymore. We're going to win. Polls didn't matter, and he lost. But the reason why he went down to the valley is because Lloyd Benson, who was on his ticket, was a congressman from the valley. And for the last 40 years, it seems like whenever someone goes down to Texas, they visit one of two places, usually either El Paso on the far western end or down in the valley. And it's usually the Democrats going to the valley. And it's because, you know, Lloyd Benson set that precedence. Now, Eagle Pass came into play because of some problems in Eagle Pass. And I've done live shots down there on that border, and it's not a war zone. I know that they are viewing it as a war zone, but having been to several conflict zones myself, I can tell you that Eagle Pass is not a war zone. And it's disingenuous to say that it is. And you can't be in a war zone if you're riding around in a grass boat going, it's really rough out here. It's not. The one place they do miss that I think every candidate should go to is Nuevo Laredo and Laredo, because those are what the Frontera on the border are really all about. That aside, the two dueling pictures that we got of Donald Trump and Joe Biden, what did they tell you about the two candidates? Michael.
One is old and frail and has cognitive deficiencies, and one is old and frail and has cognitive deficiencies. And neither of them have any clue about sane immigration policies.
John?
Succinctly
said, Michael.
Yeah. And I don't think either of them really should be shot dead.
I know you don't mean that. So
a wounding.
A stern threat. A deep talking to.
Yeah, an admonishment.
Yeah, that's right. Send them to the bed without their porridge. John.
That's exactly right.
I agree with Michael that the split screen that we got, it was fairly obvious that neither candidate for president has any new ideas for what to do about the border situation, and if they have them, they're not telling us yet, because I didn't hear very much new last week.
What do you think of Biden saying, hey, Donnie, help us out. If you want to solve the problem, be a part of the solution instead of part of the problem. Was that a smart move politically, or do you think it was silly?
Yeah, I think that was a smart move. It's not going to happen.
No.
But, you know, that's one way to combat Trump, is to invite him to be part of a solution. And he really has no interest in being part of solutions. His whole shtick is based on everything is really screwed up and everything's a disaster, and I'm the only one who can fix it. So if things start getting fixed before he can get reelected, well, that's not really in his interest, is it?
No. Yeah. And that's the bottom line with him. And I'll say it this way before we move on, because I wanted to cover this issue for just one reason only. It's the disingenuous nature of both parties in this particular case. This has been an ongoing problem since the collapse of the oil economy in Mexico in the mid-70s. It was the last piece of legislation was the Simpson-Mazzoli Act that was passed 40 years ago. And it's the issue that brought me to D.C. for the first time. And it was the simple fact that before the Simpson-Mazzoli Act, while it was illegal to cross the border, you know, illegally, it wasn't illegal to hire illegal immigrants. And so that piece of legislation made it illegal to hire illegal immigrants. However, name one large company, agribusiness, construction, oil industry, thoroughbred industry, anybody who's ever been prosecuted for it. No one. The simple fact of the matter is we continue to hire these people. We hang up the shingle that says, you know, help wanted, and then we turn it around and prosecute them for it. And neither one of these particular parties have been very good at drafting, you know, legislation that works on the border. Here you have one of the best solutions, which is to hire more. And folks, if you don't understand, the federal government, when they hire border patrolmen, these people get paid not very well. So hiring more of them and giving them a pay boost actually would help quite a bit. And that's where most of the problems are. It's not in the frontier. Drug dealers are bottom line, and sex traffickers. These people are strict capitalists. They want to sell high, buy low. So they're not going to drive their drugs on a flatbed truck to the border in the middle of nowhere, take it off the flatbed truck, put it in a skiff, put it across the border, then put it on another flatbed truck and drive it to points unknown in the U.S. They're going through the checkpoints. And in the past, it's been the Border Patrol itself that's been compromised with people, you know, drug dealers buying them off to send drugs across, as well as the trucking companies. So if you have more people inspecting on the border, you'd be able to stop a lot of the problem. But they're not interested in that. It's all about a political issue. And watching the comedy down on the border this past week just made me vomit because I've seen it all before. So with that, we're going to take another short break. And when we come back, we want to talk about Mitch McConnell. Stick around. We'll be right back. Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Caraman. With us, as always, former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin, who, as we speak, is being carted away by the Secret Service for threats against the president. No, we're just teasing. He hasn't been carted away yet. And editor-at-large from CQ, Roll Call, John Bennett. We want to end this talking about something that you and I have covered quite a bit, John, and that is Mitch McConnell. He's the leader of the Republican Party, the longest leader, majority or minority or party leader, in Congress, in congressional history, and he's stepping down from his leadership role. He'll still be a member of the Senate until 2026, he said. But in his, he's stepping away from power, and there's a speculation as to who will take his place. But I'd like to take this opportunity to ask, what has Mitch McConnell ever done for us? Not once has he ever introduced a piece of legislation, and probably his greatest accomplishment was in the destruction of Roe v. Wade, because it was he who made it, who in two cases, made it impossible for Democrats to put someone who was a little more progressive on the Supreme Court. The votes that they got led to the removal or the overturning of Roe v. Wade. John, what's your thoughts on your political obituary for Mitch McConnell?
Well, what Mitch McConnell's legacy will be is he helped Donald Trump overhaul the federal court system with conservative judges, and he delivered the current rightward lean of the U.S. Supreme Court. That's it. That's his legacy. He doesn't have, you know, that signature piece of legislation that most speakers of the House or majority leaders in the Senate have. He almost got it with the health care bill that would have repealed the Affordable Care Act. But of course, John McCain walked in the middle of the night and put his thumb down and voted no. So that would have been his one true, you know, big legislative accomplishment. But it's the court system. You know, we weren't surprised that Mitch McConnell stepped down from leadership, but we were surprised the timing. This is a little earlier than we were expecting any kind of announcement. And in his statement, McConnell did acknowledge that, you know, he said, I have a lot of faults, but not understanding politics is not one of them, and my party has changed. That is code for Trump has taken over my party, and I'm a Reagan Republican, and, you know, we're not really in style these days, so it's time for someone else to lead the Senate Republican Conference. And that is also code for someone else would have to work with Donald Trump if he's reelected.
Yeah, I think it's a fear that Donald Trump will be reelected. Is
I took it
the
as a, I took
yeah.
it as a sign, and McConnell has access to RNC polling and the Senate Republican campaign arm. They have their own polling that they buy and do, and it's a lot more detailed in a lot of cases. It's the good stuff that's been described to me by pollsters. So he sees all that, and I think this was a sign that McConnell is making. He thinks Trump more than likely will be the 47th president, and there's a shot the Republicans keep the House, even if they don't. They're not going to get to 60 votes in the Senate, but something called budget reconciliation would be unlocked for a year, and they could pass some legislation, but they would have to negotiate with the White House and the House, and there would have to be a lot of interaction between the president and a Republican Senate majority leader. And I think McConnell knows that his days of working closely with Donald Trump are long gone.
No, he never liked Donald Trump. I saw Trump.
No.
You were there a couple of times when Trump dangled him like a monkey on a leash in the
Yeah,
on the Rose Garden.
I remember an impromptu press conference in the Rose Garden, and McConnell, of course.
Looked very uncomfortable.
Well, McConnell, remember Mitch McConnell as a child had polio. He's never moved great, and Donald Trump made him stand there for over 90 minutes in the Rose Garden, and McConnell was fatigued and stiff as they and I remember as they walked back to the Oval Office. I believe it was Mike Pence had to help Mitch McConnell up the small stairs. And Trump charged right past him and went back to the Oval, and there was Mike Pence and I think another senator helping Mitch McConnell. So that was definitely a message to Mitch. It was I mean I thought it was disrespectful. I know some people who worked in the Trump White House thought it wasn't very nice either. So
Yes.
Trump refers to him as the old crow, and McConnell had criticized him really harshly after the January 6th Capitol riot, and his role.
I will say this. I find it a bit of irony that the GOP that he largely built ate him.
Yeah.
And that's, he was the architect of the GOP as it is, and they ate him. Michael, your thoughts?
I think besides the court as his legacy, which will live in my mind in infamy, is his vote not to convict in the second
Amen.
impeachment trial. Because I believe that he knew that Trump was guilty as charged, but decided to take the coward's way out of this so-called off-ramp that because he was no longer in office, he constitutionally couldn't be convicted, a point that almost every constitutional lawyer disputed. And had he voted to convict, I think Trump would have been convicted. And if he were convicted, he would not be eligible to run for election now.
So in your mind, he's not only guilty of Roe v. Wade being overturned, but the spectacle of Donald Trump getting a second whack at the presidency.
Yes.
That
And if you remember correctly, he says in voting not to convict in the Senate that he does so without guilt because he knows the criminal justice system is out there waiting for Trump and he'll get his comeuppance that way. Well, sorry, Mitch. It hasn't worked out all that well. And had you voted to convict, maybe you'd still be the minority, or if luck goes your way, majority leader. But because you voted not to convict, and Trump seems to be the heir apparent,
Yep.
and because Trump is going to pick the heir apparent, you're out, you're sort of out of job. So, that's for me. Those are the dual legacies. And I don't think either of them is very flattering.
For me, it boils down to this. The first time I interviewed Mitch McConnell, he was a county executive of Jefferson County, Kentucky. I was in high school. I was a high school reporter. and he had a civil rights commission. He believed in abortion. He supported unions, and he abandoned all of that to, if people will remember, in 1984, he was the only senator to come into office on the coattails of Ronald Reagan. So Ronald Reagan gave us Mitch McConnell, who has destroyed the GOP. I blame Ronald Reagan for all of it. But I'll say this about Mitch McConnell. The night before I went to interview him, my uncle, who knew him, and for those who don't know, back in the 60s, Mitch McConnell was part of trying to overthrow the leadership of the Republican Party in the state of Kentucky, and he lost his bid to do so, and he threw his co-conspirator under the bus, at which point in time he was given a seat of power inside the Republican Party for being subservient to the guys who were running it. That led him to the job of being county executive, which led him to the Senate. And the night before I went to interview him, my uncle, who knew him very well, said, if you're going to interview Mitch McConnell, you got to remember one thing. Mitch McConnell is about only one thing. And I asked, what is that? And he said, Mitch McConnell. And in the 40 years I've been covering him, I have never heard a more succinct nor a more exact description of Mitch McConnell. I don't think he actually cared about the issues. I think he was a political grifter with a southern smile, a soft handshake, and in his later years, a warbling cadence and voice that reminded me of a wild turkey with distemper, wandering through the woods, lost, proud, and very vocal. And I have never been more happy to see someone leave leadership than Mitch McConnell. And as we leave, I will tell you this. This just came over the wire. Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley has won her first contest in a Republican presidential nomination with the race on Sunday after triumphing in Washington, D.C.'s primary. I don't know if it's going to change the trajectory of anything, but we're going to hear Donald Trump now forever.
Does this mean tomorrow we're going to get a fresh round of Nikki Haley surging stories?
You think it's going to wait until tomorrow?
And start tonight, right?
We're going to get a round of Nikki Haley's is surging stories, and we're going to get a round of emails from Donald Trump going, Nikki Haley is a traitor and actually a Democrat. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah.
No, John, you can go ahead. I was going to say, the only thing I was going to say is this circles back to what we were talking about in the legal cases. And this is why Trump does not want to go to trial on the January 6th case in the District of Columbia. Because even among the Republican faithful,
yes,
he's not liked. So there's a very small jury pool of people who might say, you know what, Trump is guilty, but I'm going to vote not to convict because he's, you know, being persecuted and I'm going to hang the jury. That's why he doesn't want to go. That's why he doesn't want to go to trial in the District of Columbia, ladies and gentlemen.
Amen and woo hallelujah. And with that said, John, what would you like to plug?
Going to be a busy week. Everything from possible Supreme Court decision on Trump's 14th Amendment case to State of the Union to Super Tuesday. So you can follow along at rollcall.com.
And do you want to give the – I know you've got news. You haven't made it public yet. Do you want to do it? I won't if you won't.
We'll do that next week. Yeah,
okay.
We'll do that.
Sounds good.
But I will say Haley winning in D.C. means that my prediction of Trump running the table will not happen. So this is like when a team in the NFL is, you know, 11-12, 14-0. And then they lose one, and the Dolphins' perfect season is
still intact.
I did not run the table.
Go Giants. Go Giants.
Michael, what you like to plug, brother?
Well, so first I want to say a shout-out to Caitlin Clark, who passes Pistol Pete Maravich as the all-time NCAA Division I scoring leader. They refer to her now as Ponytail Pete. So good for her. My podcast is That Said with Michael Zeldin. As you know, it's a book-based podcast. I am talking to different people about different stories. Tomorrow I interview, but it won't come out for another week, Katie Couric about her book, Going There. And then later it'll be Brian Stelter on Fox and his book on Fox and Barbara McQuaid on disinformation. So there's a lot of stuff worth listening to. If you have an hour, just plug it in.
Sounds great.
On every major podcast app.
And I'd like to remind everyone on March 7th, that'll be this Thursday night, to listen to the State of the Union from President Joe Biden. We'll be talking about that next week. I didn't want to preview it this week because I hate to get ahead of those things. That's like polls to me. They're pointless. But anyway, the name of this podcast is called Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be happy to catch you next time for this edition called Just Ask the Press. Thanks. Catch you next time.